प्रसादाशु भूमि पर्यावतिष्ठति
प्रसादे on achievement of the causeless mercy of the Lord.
On achievement of the causeless mercy of the Lord.
Sarva.
Sarva.
Of all.
Of all.
Dukanam.
Dukanam.
Material miseries.
Material miseries.
Hani.
Hani.
Destruction.
Destruction.
Asya.
Asya.
His.
His.
Upajayate
takes place
prasanna chetasa of the happy minded
he
certainly
ashu
very soon
budhihi
intelligence
pari
sufficiently
avatishtate
becomes established. Translation. For one, thus satisfied in Krishna consciousness, the threefold miseries, it is a little bit too loud, of material existence exist no longer. In such satisfied consciousness, one's intelligence is soon well established. I'm sorry, but you pressed a button which makes the speakers hum. Yes, now it's over. That's good enough, I think. Yes? Achso. Mm-hmm. Let us again hear the translation. For one thus satisfied in Krishna consciousness, the threefold miseries of material existence exist no longer. In such satisfied consciousness, one's intelligence is soon well established. And the next verse reads, Nasti buddhir ayuktasya na cha yuktasya bhavana na cha ba vayata shantir ashantasya kutasukam. Translation. One who is not connected with the Supreme in Krishna consciousness can have neither transcendental intelligence nor a steady mind, without which there is no possibility of peace. And how can there be any happiness without peace? Purport. Unless one is in Krishna consciousness, there is no possibility of peace. So it is confirmed in the 5th chapter, 5:29, that when one understands that Krishna is the only enjoyer of all the good results of sacrifice and penance, that he is the proprietor of all universal manifestations, and that he is a real friend of all living entities, then only can one have real peace. Therefore, if one is not in Krishna consciousness, there cannot be a final goal for the mind. Disturbance is due to want of an ultimate goal. And when one is certain that Krishna is the enjoyer, proprietor and friend of everyone and everything, then one can, with a steady mind, bring about peace. Therefore, one who is engaged without a relationship with Krishna is certainly always in distress and is without peace, however much he may make a show of peace and spiritual advancement in life. Krishna consciousness is a self-manifested peaceful condition which can be achieved only in relationship with Krishna. Namaham Vishnu Padaya Krishna Parishtaya Bhutale Srimate Bhakti Vedanta Swaminiti Namine Namaste Sarasvati Devam Gauravani Pracharine Nirvishesha Shunyavari Paskatya Deshatarine Jaya Sri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda Veta Garadha Shivashadi Gaur Bhakta Vrinda Hare Krishna 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 Hare 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 Rama 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 Hare 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 Krishna 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 Hare 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 Rama 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 Hare Hare. Let us again hear the translation. For one thus satisfied in Krishna consciousness, the threefold miseries of material existence exist no longer. In such satisfied consciousness, one's intelligence is soon well established. One who is not connected with the Supreme in Krishna consciousness can have neither transcendental intelligence nor a steady mind, without which there is no possibility of peace. And how can there be any happiness without peace? So here, in a very interesting way, we should say, the Bhagavad Gita gives a final analysis of the culture of intelligence. Usually, the cultures around us are the cultures of the body. With the culture of the body, we mean things like the gymnasiums, bodybuilding shops, discotheques, dance balls, and so on and so forth. Then, slightly above this, is the culture of the mind. With mind, we mean literature, well, literatures of different in different areas. With the culture of the mind, we mean the unending waves of mental speculations which are manifesting themselves in science, in art, and so on and so forth. We mean opera houses and places which are sought for people who like to enjoy. And then there's a platform of the culture of the intelligence. Now you will be rather amazed, if not totally shocked, to hear that Bhagavad Gita is said to be the culture of intelligence. Why so? Why is the philosophy of Bhagavad Gita described to be a culture of intelligence? This is an interesting point, which is a central theme of a lecture series which I'm just now preparing. To make it a little brief here, let me just sum up a few essential points without telling you the whole thing. Yes. See, this world can be... Let me just find out. Du bist in der philosophischen Stimmung, oder? Dass ich einen Zuhörer habe. Du auch, Tribhanga? Mm-hmm. Please, Babus, it is Gabriel so and so. It is a little necessary that you want to really hear this so that I'm inspired to talk about this, because I do have to think a little, and if the audience is not interested, it won't come out in the proper way. There's an active relationship between a Vaishnav speaker and his Vaishnav audience, which you please help me a little bit. We are discussing the question, why is Bhagavad Gita to called the culture of intelligence? Now, before actually, I want to make it real short, so I will just tell you one function of the intelligence. The one function of the intelligence is to recognize something. To give you a rather easy example, say you hear some tune, you're in maybe in the shopping street, and you hear some melody. Now your mind perceives all these sounds in a cacophony of sounds, a wirrwarr of sounds. But if your intelligence is tuned in, you might fix it on one sound and think, well, I have heard this sound before, this melody before in my life, and you recognize it as maybe a symphony of... Wer schreibt Symphonien heute? later symphony, Bach is symphonies, no,
Beethoven,
a symphony of Beethoven, you recognize it. Or let us say, you see a person, this is often so in preaching programs, a preacher might return to a town where he has given several preaching programs, and all of a sudden, from within the audience, he sees them all of a sudden consciously. This is a person I was preaching to half a year ago, or this is a person I thought at that time might become a devotee. I did have this experience very much in the Ljubljana concert. I can say a little, we had a very big program in one sports hall, and we were giving a program, and then in the first row or second row, where we danced at the end, I saw Bhakti Barbara, and I, first of all, I thought, well, I have seen this face somewhere before, then I looked again. No, it is not. It is not possible. Then I looked again. I saw her maybe, and so and so much time ago. This was you know this experience. I think which you see her face is not special in the sense of that there are many people who have eyes and eyebrows and hair on the head and so on and so forth. It's not something very extraordinary, but of course it's an individual face which can only be recognized if all of a sudden something happens, the function of the intelligence starts. Do you know what I mean to say? It's called the form intelligence can perceive and recognize, wiedererkennen, forms and so on and so forth. Someone who has no intelligence to see, he will only see different colored objects, and he won't be able to really distinguish between the objects, between persons, melodies, and so on and so forth. So that's the function of the intelligence. So after having established this one point, let's move a step ahead. Srila Prabhupada explains in a chapter in the Bhagavatam that by using a little intelligence, one can positively understand that he exists. I mean, think about this. You are here. You're a person different from other persons, and certainly different from the objects which surround you, the floor, the cushion, the wall against which you might be leaning, and so on and so forth. So by using this intelligence to distinguish, we were saying it, intelligence means to distinguish and recognize the different forms. You can feel that you are different from your hands, your head, your stomach, means belly, your ears, your hair, your feet, and so on and so forth. And you can understand that this body is an object for you, the subject, which you use. In classical philosophy, this is the difference between the seer and the seen. So now in Western philosophy, all of Western philosophy, mind was always considered to be a subject, and the body was also the subject. Only the environment and things in the environment were considered to be the objects used by the person. However, in Krishna conscious philosophy, we understand that the body is also an object. It is the non-conscious entity, it is made from material elements, it's material energies. And we also do understand that our celebrated mind is an object only. It is the subject. It is the subject is only the pure soul or pure consciousness which observes the mind and its wanderings, and which certainly observes the body and also the environment surrounding our bodies. It's a great difference. Now, to really understand and feel yourself, you need the help of the distinguishing factor of intelligence. And Bhagavad Gita, first instruction you will be glad to hear, is based on this distinction between body and self. There is a very clear example given in the second chapter, where the body is compared with a piece of cloth, like a shirt, and so on and so forth. So the Bhagavad Gita starts on the platform of intelligence, and the Srimad Bhagavatam, and which are narrations about the Supreme Personality of Godhead, the Kingdom of God, that means totally transcendent things, is on the platform of the soul. It is spiritual. Have you understood this? Yeah, it is not so difficult, isn't it? So, when hearing this, when a Krishna conscious devotee hears this, he immediately wants to come on the platform of the soul. He doesn't want to be on the platform of the body and on the platform of the mind. Why not? Because the body and the mind are easily, they are arrangements given to us by the material energy, and they are easily disturbed by that same material energy. The body can easily develop a cough. The body is a bag of flesh and fat and a lot of gas and urine and so on and so forth. And the mind, in a similar way, is also like a bag which contains so many garbage things produced by the two functions of the mind, desire and hate. I like this and I don't like that. So a Krishna conscious person doesn't like to act on this platform at all. He wants to relate by his purified intelligence to the platform of the soul, that is the seer, which is different from the environment. And he is a part of the transcendental world in proper perspective. This is a very nice point, therefore it is said, if you are not connected with the Supreme, that means if you are not practicing the culture of the soul, so to say, you cannot have a transcendental intelligence nor a steady mind, without which there is no possibility of peace. The soul, which has fallen into the material energy, can only be at peace if he is linked up in yoga with the Supreme. If he is not, he will be violently pushed away by the material energy, although he is at no stage ever material. The example has been given of a drop of oil which falls into a current, ein Strom. It is pushed away by the waves downstream and becomes, so to say, totally dependent on the waves, the whirlpools, and whatever arrangements are there in the stream of the rocks against which it is pushed, and so on and so forth. So in a similar analogous way, the soul, which has fallen into the stream of material energy, is constantly under the influence of matter. You have to come to the transcendental platform, otherwise you will suffer. Prabhupada says, if one is not in Krishna consciousness, there cannot be a final goal for the mind. Disturbance is due to want of an ultimate goal. And when one is certain that Krishna is the enjoyer, proprietor and friend of everyone and everything, then one can with a steady mind bring about peace. So those who are not fixed on Krishna consciousness, but who are fully under the control of their mind and their senses, can never be in a steady position. Even their friendship, even their discipleship, even their all kinds of relationships, they can never be steady in that, because they are disturbed by the material energy. So this is one thing. Then a second point which we wanted to bring about is one which describes, so to say, a person who is on the platform of the soul, who's practicing the culture of the soul. See, every conditioned soul in this material world is, so to say, pushed away by the stream of material energy. Now within this stream there are three currents. One is of course the mode of passion, the mode of ignorance and the mode of goodness. Sometimes we are dancing on the stream of material energy and we are very happy. Things look very prosperous. The future, a good future seems to be at hand and we are encouraged. Our determination is very steadfast. It is then we are pushed away by a different current, Strömung. That is the mode of passion. We become very dependent on honor and on material gains, which or fruits, which are there for our own enjoyment. That is called yes. And our determination is no longer very steadfast. It can break easily if we do not get the desired fruit. And then on this stream of material energy, we are sometimes floating on the mode of ignorance, by which we become depressed, by which we become a little dull and less inspired for Krishna consciousness. This is the condition of the soul in the river of material life. So a fortunate soul is someone who comes in the association of devotees and hears from them the transcendental philosophy of the Bhagavad Gita, because it is this philosophy which can bring him on the shore ans Ufer, outside of the constant pushing of the river of material energy in his consciousness. Now, as soon as someone is in this association of devotees and is also a devotee, he is developing a very interesting mood. He prays, "My dear Lord, it does not matter where I am born, but let me born even as an ant in the house of a devotee." A pure devotee does not pray to the Lord for liberation from this material bondage. Actually, the pure devotee never thinks that he is fit for liberation. Considering his past life and his mischievous activities, he thinks that he is fit to be sent to the lower region of hell. If in this life I am trying to become a devotee, this does not mean that in my many past lives I was 100% pious. That is not possible. A devotee, therefore, is always conscious of his real position. A devotee always prays, "For my misdeeds, may I be born again and again, but my only prayer is that I may not forget your service." The devotee has that much mental strength, and he prays to the Lord, may I be born again and again, but let me be born in the home of your pure devotee, so that I may again get a chance to develop myself. So, see, once a devotee has understood his actual position in life, he becomes very humble, and by this humbleness, he becomes very, very pleasing to the Supreme Personality of Godhead, who then makes a quick arrangement to drag him back home, back to Godhead. This is what we were trying to explain this morning in the opening explanation to the lecture. We are hoping against hope for the mercy of the Supreme Personality of Godhead upon us. But this mercy will be easily attracted once we understand our true position, and once we understand the fortune of doing devotional service. Someone who surrenders to the devotional service will get all protection from all kinds of sins. But he who does not surrender, who takes things in his own hand, has a difficult task ahead of him. See, I wanted to tell you one. Here Prabhupada was explaining how the devotee should be aware that in his past life he must have done several sinful activities. So I wanted to read from you, from the Gaga Samhita, about the past lives of people which you know or might not know. It depends how well you have read the Krishna book. See, you might remember when Krishna came into Mathura, there was a washerman who had the cloth of Kamsa. Now Krishna felt like dressing in those clothes, which were very nice, colorful, and so on and so forth. So he told the washerman, you please give me these cloths, I want to dress with them, and I have all my friends with them, let's look colorful. So the washerman actually didn't agree to this proposal. He said, how can you dare to ask for the king's cloth? Go away, you rascal cowherd boy. So after he said this, Krishna took his hand and just chopped off his head. Now some of you, when reading it, might have felt that this is very drastic, very unusual behavior, you know, to just get into karate. So you might all have thought how unusual Krishna's activity is, and you must have asked yourself, why did he do this? Isn't it? I think Tadvasandhava, this question has come up. At least one has thought, this is quite unusual, isn't it? I mean, imagine, he's sitting there having his clothes, you can't take the king's clothes. I mean, it's somewhat understandable if he doesn't know who Krishna is that he reacts in such a way. So why should, I mean, Krishna didn't do this with everyone who didn't recognize him as the Supreme Personality of Godhead. So why did he did this in this particular instance? Who was the Vashaman in his previous birth? It must have something to do with his previous life. Why did Krishna kill him? And why did his spiritual effulgence merge in Lord Krishna's body? This is the question. So Sri Narada Muni answered this. O King of Videha, in Treta Yuga, in Lord Rama's kingdom, you all know who is Ramachandra, in Ayodhya, as Lord Rama's spies overheard, this same washerman said to his wife, I will not maintain you, a sinner that returns at dawn from another's house. Ramachandra, who is greedy to enjoy with his wife, may continue to maintain his sita, but I am not like him. Is to give those of you who don't have the background, after Ramachandra had reclaimed Sita from Ravana, the demon who had kidnapped his wife Sita, she became again queen in Ramachandra's capital Ayodhya. And so once the spies overheard a washerman speaking to his wife. This wife returned in the evening at dawn, and the washerman suspected her that she had been together with another that Hare Krishna, Jai, Hari Bol. To welcome you, I will give you a little bit the background where we are just now, so that you can follow what to follow. We have heard about Krishna who entered Mathura and saw the washerman with the king's cloth, and he demanded these cloths to dress colorfully. The washerman didn't agree. He said, "How can you dare?" And then Krishna, without any comment and warning, just killed him by cutting off his head from his shoulder, not even with a weapon, but just with his hand. So we all are now very curious, who was this washerman? I mean, why did Krishna do this? This is so drastic, so unusual. And why did the effulgence of the soul of the washerman enter into Krishna's body? So the explanation which Narada Muni gives is that this was a washerman in the kingdom of Lord Rama who, when his wife returned a little late, suspected her to be, unchaste. And therefore said, "I will not maintain you, a sinner that returns at dawn," so Abendstimmung, so Abenddämmerung, "from another's house. Ramachandra, who is greedy to enjoy with his wife, may continue to maintain his Sita," who was with Ravana, "but I'm not like him." Hearing from many mouths that the people were criticizing him, Lord Ramachandra at once exiled Sita to the forest. And therefore he suffered greatly to be separated from his dear beloved wife Sita, and all the people of Ayodhya suffered very much, and Sita also suffered very much. He did this to be free of any blame. Lord Ramachandra had no wish to punish him, and in due course this person became a washerman in Mathura at the end of Dwapara Yuga. To stop his blasphemy, however, Lord Krishna killed him. Then the Lord, who is an ocean of mercy, gave him liberation. So, so there are different. Then, on the other hand, then there are different other personalities described. But I just wanted to bring this one personality to your attention. He was a sinner before in his previous life, and a blasphemer against the Lord. Now, by some trend, because he was directly in association with Lord Ramachandra, he somehow again got the association of the Lord and was killed. But see, we are not so fortunate. When we entered the material world, we were also overcome by this unpleasant attitude which the washerman had. We are what is it called? Icha dvesha samuttena dvandva oho mohena bharata. Sarge yanti yantra hi sarvabhutani samohan sarge yanti parantapa. This verse means When the soul enters the material universe, he is overcome by desire and hatred towards the Supreme Personality of Godhead. He dresses first in the garments of desire, and then he is dressed up in the desires of hate. It means we can all experience this in our life, how we desire certain things and hate other or dislike other things. So the original cloth, so to say, of desire and hatred is desire for material enjoyment and hatred towards the Supreme Personality of Godhead and surrender to his mission. Now, we have many different life forms dressed up in this unfortunate garment, this unfortunate dress, and to some extent we are still dressed. We have to purify our desire and we have to purify our hate if we want to go back home, back to Godhead. We have to learn how to desire Krishna. It is said, just like a materialist likes to taste the lips of a beautiful woman, little erotic language, but it's in the Hari, where is it? In Padyavali. So the devotee likes to taste the holy name. It's an activity of desire. And just like a materialist will read again and again a love letter sent to him by his or her beloved, a devotee will read again, will chant again and again, say again and again out loud the holy names. This is how we have to desire for Krishna. We have to consequently abhor or reject the things which are not favorable for the devotional service of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. This was one point we have to learn. So, for those of you who did not come at the who were not with us in the beginning of the lecture, I want to, and also for those of you who were a little exhausted maybe due to so much service today, and who have not retained this point, we spoke in the beginning of four kinds of cultures. We spoke of the culture of the body, which is the culture which is going on downstairs, so to say. There's a sunset, drinking, football, maybe on the sports show, fighting in Yugoslavia, starving in Russia, following the hawk sampradaya in Germany. This is all called the culture of the body. Then there's the culture of the mind, you know, entertainments, literature, philosophies, science, and so on. Then there's the culture of intelligence. This is based on the subjects of Bhagavad Gita, where the eternal is distinguished from the non-permanent, where the consciousness is described to be the only subject in this world. That means the individual soul and everything else, including mind and body and environment, is described to be an object used by the soul, but also exerting its influence on the contaminated consciousness of the soul. It's called citta in Sanskrit, this contaminated or material consciousness. So, and we spoke of the necessity to engage in things of, and hear and think about things of the transcendental world, which is the culture of the soul proper. So I want to please all my audience this evening by talking about something very transcendental, the culture of the soul. I think our Sankirtan devotees have starved for something. I want to talk a little on the flute of Krishna and the eighth notes which Krishna plays on this flute. This will be of interest also to our musically minded devotees like Tribhanga and others. So, see, Krishna's flute vibrates 8 different tunes. Demigods like Lord Brahma and Lord Shiva break their meditation and forget everything when the first tune pierces their ears. Lord Shiva stops playing his dindim drum. You know, Lord Shiva likes to play the drum and dance a little, or a lot. Lord Brahma sits astonished on his lotus flower, and Lord Ananta Shesh begins swaying hypnotically. The second tune, so this is when Krishna starts playing his one tune. Then Lord Brahma begins to sit up astonished. Now, usually Lord Brahma is engaged in cultural entertainment in the heavenly planets. He watches different festivities. But he just sits there. And Ananta Shesh begins swaying hypnotically. Sometimes when he becomes too rhythmically, the world order is disturbed and planets are shaking and earthquakes are there. It's sometimes the reason is Ananta Shesha gets too much into it. Now, when Krishna starts playing the second tune, the Yamuna River begins to flow backwards upstream and begins to offer lotus flower at the lotus feet of the Lord. So, when Krishna begins to play the third tune, the moon stops moving. And when Krishna plays the fourth tune, the cows run up to Krishna and stand motionless with upraised ears to drink the nectar of the fourth tune. Why are the ears upraised? Because then the nectar doesn't flow out of it. But if it's like this, it flows easily out of it. So, because they don't want the nectar to flow out of it, they go like whoop. A very unusual posture for cows to hold their ears, as you might admit. This is what the cows do when they hear the fourth note, the fourth tune. The fifth tune brings the gopis madly running, eager for Krishna's loving association. See, sometimes the gopis, they feel that Krishna's flute music is like a strong wind, and they are like the dried leaves which you can sometimes see in the autumn falling into a tempest. Tempest is storm. So they feel also moved by that. Now the sixth tune creates autumn, replete with rich foliage, blossoms and fruits. In other words, Krishna only needs to blow in his flute, and then all of a sudden the forest begins to blossom and fruits come. Stones also melt when they hear the sixth tune. Imagine. Vrindavan, you are able to see this with your own eyes. You can see the lotus footprint of the Lord in stones. If you want to see this, please come Sunday evening to our slideshow. We will present to you, for the first time ever shown in the Western world, the slides of the last Brajmandal Parikram. It is an experience which no one of you should miss if he has even only half a body left. The seventh note instantly ushers in all six seasons at the same time, manifesting their full splendor with soft, sensuous southern breezes carrying the perfumed aromas of the flesh of the fresh forest flowers. The eighth note of the relentless flute of Shyama Sundara takes the name of Sri Radha, steals her self-control, and forcibly speeds Radha to meet her beloved Krishna. Then Radha paints the lotus feet. No. Radha paints her own lotus feet with the black mascara. This is the black ointment which goes around here. She paints her lotus feet with that, and the red leg dye, because she is so much, this is so much, it's just too much Krishna's. So there is a Srimad Bhagavatam, this all is said. O pious mother Yashoda, your son who is expert in all the acts of herding cows, has invented many new styles of flute playing. When Krishna takes his flute to his bimba red lips and sends forth the tunes of the harmonic scale in variegated melodies. Devanga, hast du verstanden? Rama, Shiva, Indra and other chief demigods become confused upon hearing the sound. Although they are the most learned authorities, they cannot ascertain the essence of that music, and thus they bow down their heads and hearts. So this is Krishna's flute play. He, with his flute, sometimes he has created, just by playing the flute, Radha, he has created Shyama Kund and other Kundas as well. Krishna can create, I think it's, yes, he has created Shyama Kund, that is said in Samhita. So this description, I wanted to just make this description to you, to show you things of the spiritual dimension. And you will be glad to hear, by hearing more and more of Sri Krishna, his wonderful pastimes and activities, which are in that spiritual dimension, we can be purified more and more in our lives, so that even while being in this material life, we can become happy, and our desires to attain the lotus feet of the Lord can be fulfilled. There is a potency within these transcendental narrations of Sri Krishna and his, you know, everything about him. There's this potency there which can be felt by any sincere Vaishnav who endeavors to remember Krishna, fix his mind on Krishna, who tries to become Krishna's devotee, who worships Krishna and who pays his obeisances. I wanted to make a point on paying obeisances in the temple. It is nice if whenever you come to the deities, you pay your obeisances, not just this fleeting, also flüchtige obeisances, but pay real obeisance, because Krishna is very pleased by this. He says so. The essence of his instructions is one of the is, or think of me, become my devotees, worship me, pay your obeisances to me. Have you ever thought about it? Says obeisance. Now, when you make an obeisance, you can either use 6 or 8 limbs of your body. 8 limbs is when you are fully there, boom, like a rod, dandavat. Now, the most ingredient, most important ingredient in either the full or the other obeisances, which most of us prefer to do, which the Matajis also do, the most important ingredient is your mind. You just say something, that's not a real obeisance. It's like a body with half a stomach, so to say, or no stomach. It's not functioning properly. So the obeisance without paying your mind you know, bowing with your mind before the Lord is not complete. Your mind has to be there. So Hare Krishna, we want to end with this potpourri of points. I always feel when we have classes to the devotees, there are certain styles of giving classes. One is to just make a few points, hoping they are interesting, changing, and inspiring the audience. So Hare Krishna, I want to end here. Thank you for listening. Do you have any questions regarding all this? Bhagavatam.
I wanted to know if I understood correctly. You said that the Bhagavad Gita is written on the intelligence platform.
Culture, it's the culture of the intelligence, yes.
It is possible to understand Bhagavad Gita on the intellectual platform?
See, when you hear intelligence, you have the you don't think of Buddhi Yoga. Buddhi, the intelligence which analyzes things and understands spirit, differentiates from spirit and matter. You think of matter speculation, which is usually the determination, which is usually what intellectual people do nowadays. An intellectual cannot understand the Bhagavad Gita if he doesn't come off the platform of the mind and get to the platform of intelligence. Now, the way we define intelligence in our philosophy is to recognize form. Of course, there's material intelligence, but if that intelligence is properly used, you will be able to understand that you are different from matter, and you will come to a spiritual conclusion. So, yes, a truly intelligent person has to come to Krishna consciousness and will come to Krishna consciousness. Those who study this conversation with their intelligence, how is the exact quote?
Worship.
Those who study this conversation worship me with their intelligence. This Bhagavad Gita speaks of the culture of purified intelligence.
But that doesn't necessarily mean that we can understand Bhagavad Gita with our intelligence, doesn't it? Because Bhagavad Gita, Krishna says, you can understand only with bhakti.
Yes. But you have to be intelligent to understand the Bhagavad Gita. In other words, a bhakta has the intelligence to understand the Gita. Now, if you... This is a very interesting question which forces me to give a few of my jewels here for free away. No, I'm just expressing it poetically. I mean, you know that we like to speak. In the second canto of Srimad Bhagavatam, chapter 2, verse number 34 or 35, one of the two, Prabhupada speaks of a process whereby which you can come to understand Paramatma, the Super Soul. And I have this just a little while ago given you the first step in this, which is to distinguish the seer from the seen, consciousness, the soul, from its material environment, which is the mind, body, and ultimately the world around. So this has to be done with intelligence. If you do apply your intelligence properly, you can understand Krishna. Prabhupada makes this point. Now he says that the other way, that's the way which you know. If someone just surrenders to the Supreme Personality of Godhead and gets the intelligence. But see, these books are meant to convince people on the platform of intelligence. There are intelligent arguments. Then you can understand. Now, of course, you can fully understand only. You can understand that there must be a God by intelligence. But you can fully understand that God, of course, only by bhakti. But you can come to the conclusion that there must be Krishna. Can invite you to my... as I said, I'm just working on this because this is a subject of great interest to the world. And then... very interesting subject, man. No, an intelligent man must become Krishna conscious, Bhagavad Dharma.
It reminds me of the example of this German god brother of Srila Prabhupada, who understood that Krishna, the Supreme Lord, is intelligent.
Yeah. He see, when you think of intelligence, you think, ooh, the fools, the materialistic. But this is not this is duskritina. Misused intelligence.
Can you please tell me which was exactly second canto?
Second canto, chapter 2, verse number 34 or 35. It is there. It is said the Supreme Lord can be inferred. Inferred, and or another word which is used is hypothesized. Also man kann inference durch eine inference. Ach, diese deutsche Sprache, da muss man jetzt, kurz das deutsche, Inference. Wie ist denn das deutsche Wort hier? Ja, man Bezug herstellen. The Supreme Lord can be inferred by the intelligence. Prabhupada gave an example, very simple example. He said, look at this body. Why is it moving? Why is the blood flowing? Because there is a soul present. If it goes, it is no longer moving and the blood is no longer flowing. Now look at the universe. Doesn't the movements of the stars, the changing of seasons, indicate that there is a supreme soul? These fools, they don't understand that there is a supreme personality of God behind it. He made his point again. Why, if there's movement in this body, which is like a small universe, there must be soul. So there must be supreme soul. Any intelligent man can understand. Now, our scientists, Bhaktivedanta Institute scientists, they have the duty to express this. Argument in a way which is very, very complicated, and so that the intellectuals can understand it. And they do so. They have very strong arguments. You can ask Madhavendra Puri, what do you say here? And he says the T4 bacteriophage shows us. And so then he gets into this. Yeah, Trivanga. Good. Back to Uwe. Ja, geht ja schnell mit einem Schlag. Fliegen sie alle wie die, sterben sie wie die Fliegen am Klebeband, die Fragen. Noch was, Ramapriya? Good, then I'm thinking it's late enough to end the day. Some attempts to read about Krishna, so that we dream of Krishna. Hare Krishna!